On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf one of our favorite guests, Will Hazelgrove, who is the national best-selling author of 19 books, has written articles for the Smithsonian Magazine and USA Today. His books have been Book of the Month selections, Literary Guild selections, and History Book Club selections. His recent publications include, but are not limited to, 160 Minutes, The Race to Save the RMS Titanic, Morristown, The Darkest Winter of the Revolutionary War and the Plot to Kidnap George Washington, Sally Rand, American Sex Symbol, Knox's Noble Train, the story of a Boston bookseller's heroic expedition that saved the American Revolution, and Al Capone in the 1933 World's Fair, The End of the Gangster Era in Chicago, among others. And his latest book is Greed in the Gilded Age, The Brilliant Con of Cassie Chadwick. It's from Roman and Littlefield. And Will, it's great to have you back on the bookshelf with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
There actually are several other books that are not even listed on the little biographical blurb that we talked about through the years. But I've got to admit that this one is, again, interesting in a new and different way. First of all, we need to probably explain exactly what we mean when we talk about the Gilded Age.
Oh, yeah, sure. That was basically the era from 1865 to, really, I like to date it to Titanic, 1912. And, you know, it's just this age of rapid industrialization in America where incredible wealth was generated. It's really where the 1% came from. Up to then, we were an agrarian society. And then after the Civil War, largely due to all the railroad lines that were laid to move the troops around, well, we had a national market. You know, so suddenly you weren't selling your corn in the town of your local town. You were shipping it off to Chicago or New York where your price was being set. Also, people started to sell their time for a wage. This was something new in America, so you know, we needed all these foundries to have all the workers, and so you know, this sort of begat this incredible wealth, untaxed, I might add, that formed this class. They call it the 400 families, and they were the richest families in America. And so money seemed to be everywhere suddenly. Mark Twain coined the Gilded Age, which basically means the gild, which is the patina overlaying, say, rotting wood, sort of a gold patina on rotting wood. And that's how Twain saw it. You know, he saw it as just, you know, all this money but terrible values, and, you know, small town morality was going out the door. And this really ushered in what we really view now as our sort of urban society.
Right. We made a quantum leap in what had always been in the United States to something very different. Like you said, it flipped us from being a primarily agrarian country, the yeoman farmers that Thomas Jefferson envisioned, to being an industrial giant. And we were making our move and becoming a great nation on the world stage during this era. Now, one of the figures, and this was something that I thought was interesting, the way that you did this, and this was to present two different figures of this Gilded Age. Andrew Carnegie, who's the best known of the two, he was an industrialist who just ended up making tons and tons and tons of money. And even when the trust busters tried to change that, he ended up making more money. He couldn't quit making money. And eventually, after amassing this fortune, he began to realize that if he was going to have any kind of legacy, he needed to do something a little more altruistic with it. And that began that one of the things that he did was the Carnegie libraries that were put all over the United States. In fact, we had one here in Troy, right next to the old Troy Normal School, which is what Troy University was when it first began as a teacher's college. So they were ubiquitous. But so his story is important to contrast with somebody who claimed to be related to him. And that's the other half of the story.
Yeah, that would be Elizabeth Bigley, who was a drifter from Canada. And she, you know, you always wonder if maybe criminal intent comes at birth. Elizabeth Bigley might prove that. She pulled off her first con when she wasn't even 20. printing up little cards in her hometown saying she was going to inherit $15,000, and went into a bank and got a line of credit and then spread, you know, phony money all over town until they caught up with her. She ended up going to trial. They said she basically acted like she was insane. And they said, we won't put you in jail, but you have to go. And so she left and went to America, which was just fine with her, and lived with her sister in Cleveland, who was sort of living a bourgeois life with her husband. And Elizabeth is taken with America, and this feeling of money is, you know, just around the corner, that the streets are lined with gold and, you know, it's there for the taking. And she has a strange yearning very early on for the expense of life, you know, good clothes, fine dining, great hotels. And so she immediately starts going around and hawking, well, before she does that, first she gets a bunch of loans, just unsecured, using the same little scam saying she's an Irish heiress. And then she hawks her sister's furniture. You know, they come for the furniture, and her husband's there, her sister's husband, and he throws her out, you know. And so, you know, this woman, this drifter, is really who we're talking about now. And, you know, this is a time in America when you can change your name pretty much at will. There is no Social Security number. That would come to the 30s. There's no real way to identify people. Right. So she takes advantage of this and starts a series of aliases.
The amazing thing to me is that she could go into a bank, give them a plausible story, produce some fake documents, and they would loan her money just based on the fact that they figured she'd have to pay them back. And these unsecured loans, there was an angle to it that they were given at very high interest rates, so that the person making the loan would basically be skimming off the top. So it's not that just that these were naive fools. They were greedy too, and figured, well, this is a way to make some a little extra money for me and for the bank. And but it turned out to be a disaster, as you say in the book. No one's actually sure the exact amount that she fleeced out of bankers. Some newspapers have it at $1 million, some at $10 million. For our purposes, it seemed close to $2 million in 1904 dollars as the most accurate. And $2 million in 1904 was a vast fortune.
Absolutely. Well, and you point out a great thing. Banks lent on perceived wealth. You know, today we have credit checks, FICO scores, all sorts of things, right? You have to give your firstborn to get a loan, right?
Right.
Well, then they lent on perceived wealth. In other words, she could go in there and they would think, oh, here's this wealthy woman, because she would play that up. She had a little lisp. She was attractive, had a good figure. She dressed very well. And she would come in like a grand dame of you know, untold millions. And the bankers got sucked in. And they would then, you know, give her, you know, this money, virtually not checking her background or anything. And like you said, they would hit her with high interest rates and also kickbacks. Bankers were expected to get kickbacks. So let's say you'd get a loan for $50,000. You were expected to kick back $10,000 to the bank. Mm-hmm. So you know, in this way, you're right, these bankers were enriching themselves. And so Cassie realized, she's very smart. She realizes very early that people are greedy and that these men regard her as an idiot. Basically, women are third-class citizens. They don't have the vote. And, you know, she is not expected to know the intricacies of the financial world. In fact, she does. And so she plays this and moves along, getting one loan after another, and really elevates herself, becomes a clairvoyant for a while. This is a time when people wanted to talk to the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Fleeces a bunch of people out of that, until finally she meets a guy named Dr. Chadwick, who's a renowned physician in Cleveland, lives on Millionaire's Row, which is where all the rich people live. And he has a daughter and a mother who needs to be looked after. And Cassie passes herself off, or rather Elizabeth passes herself off as this rich heiress again. And they get married, and suddenly her name is Cassie Chadwick. And she has servants. She has multiple cars. And one would think at this point that would be enough, but that is not enough for her. So what does she do? She comes up with the greatest con of her time. She decides that this con, she's going to say she's the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. And this will allow the big money to flow in, because suddenly she's going to New York, and she's meeting a guy named James Dillon, who is a banker, a lawyer, financier. She says, can you give me a ride to my father's house? He takes her to Fifth Avenue, to an address he gives her in front of the Carnegie Mansion. His jaw drops open. She says, I'll be right back. She goes in and talks to a maid for a little bit. And then after maybe 20 minutes, she comes back out, drops a document, a trust agreement, that Dillon picks up and reads. That says basically the Carnegie fortune is going to come to her.
And this becomes the biggest con of all, isn't it? And yeah. Nothing that Andrew Carnegie tells reporters is as titillating as the possibility that maybe he's covering this up and she's telling the truth, even though she has been a marvelously successful liar her entire life.
That's right. And, you know, as you know, sex sells. And this was covered in, you know, I put this book together through newspapers, and there are thousands and thousands of articles. And so what does she do? She takes this, she tells this James Dillon guy that she's the illegitimate daughter going to inherit, and says, don't tell anybody. And he runs and tells everybody.
Of course.
Right? And she knows this. Then she goes and finds a guy named Beckworth. And Beckworth is a bank, smaller bank president, but he's one of those old 19th century bankers where, you know, he's very conservative, he knows all his investors, and, you know, he's grown his bank. Well, this woman shows up one night and says, basically, you know, I've got a story to tell you. And so she tells him the whole story of being the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie and says, I have to park my money somewhere and I want to do it in your bank. And he can't believe it. But Cassie has covered her tracks. Before she goes and sees him, she went and saw a guy named Ira Reynolds. And Ira Reynolds had another bank, a Wade Park bank. And she presented him with a little package and said, in this package is $5 million worth of Carnegie securities. And she tells him the whole story of being his illegitimate daughter. And he goes to open the package, and she says, you don't doubt my word, do you? And he looks at her, and he's like, well, of course, this is the late 19th century, early 20th century. A woman's word is law. And he says, oh, no problem. He puts it in the safe and gives her a line of credit for $5 million. That's what she takes to Beckworth. And Beckworth sees this and immediately assumes she is who she says she is. And she says, but my father, Andrew's mad at me. So could you just give me, you know, a small loan, say, of $50,000 to start, and I'll pay you right back. And Beckworth does it. And this is her con. She takes that first loan, pays it back very quickly, right? And then she gets another loan from another bank and uses that money to pay another bank. And with Beckworth, what she basically does is clean out his bank to the point where Beckworth gives her $100,000 of his own money, and his bank fails. The bank fails. The Oberlin Bank fails because why? There's no FDIC. Right. And he's lent out all the money, and a run happens on his bank. And this is really her Achilles heel, because up to now she's just taking money from all these different people. She also goes to a guy named Pastor Eaton. And Pastor Eaton is a pastor to J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller. And she tells him this story and says, you can't tell anybody I'm the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie, but I need to, you know, find a good bank I can trust. And so he gives her entree into all these New York banks where she goes and cleans them out. And so this house of cards, all this house of cards comes down to a loan called the Newton Loan, which she borrows from a guy named Newton to the tune of about $190,000. And Newton says, well, you got to pay me back when it comes due. And she tries to do the same thing of putting him off But Newton hires a private detective who discovers all these loans. And they go after her, and they try, and they, the feds go after her, and it's with a big chase. You know, it kind of starts in the beginning of the book in New York, where they finally catch her. Because what was she trying to do? She was trying to leave America. Mm-hmm. She was trying to go to Europe. Right. And if she got there, she would have gotten away.
Yeah.
But they get her, and that brings us to what will be called the trial of the century.
Now, I want to take a break here just for a minute to introduce another level of corruption that you bring out in this book. We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Will Hazelgrove, whose latest book is Greed in the Gilded Age, The Brilliant Con of Cassie Chadwick. It's from Roman and Littlefield. This is, we're going to step back a couple of years at this point, and the fellow's name is Daniel Sickles. I recently ran across his name in a novel about the Battle of Gettysburg. He was a political appointee as a general. He thought he was a big deal. He thought he was the guy that was going to be the hero of Gettysburg, and instead he puts the entire Union army at terrible risk because he disobeys direct orders and kicks off a fight, and his troops are surrounded before he even realizes it. And he loses a leg there to a cannonball, has the leg sent to the new army hospital where it will be preserved in awaiting his burial when it will be buried with him. And he was, at the time, was a big, big supporter of Abraham Lincoln. So now we go forward 13 years from there. It's 1876. And this is one of the most corrupt political bargains to be as high up in the government that ever occurred. And this is, for people who know something about Reconstruction, know where I'm going with this. And this was the deal that basically ensured that Reconstruction would just be stopped dead in our centennial year, and that Rutherford B. Hayes would become the president. And that was the deal. That if he got put into office, then that'd be the end of Reconstruction, and all the troops would go home, and they could in the places where they had been just waiting for their chance to reinstate all of the kind of people that believe that black people were naturally inferior, et cetera. They were going to roll the time back to a pre-Civil War. And that Jim Crow era would last really until the 1960s, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah, and that's right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I intersperse Cassie's story with lots of those kind of stories of the Gilded Age.
Yes.
Where, you know, everything was for sale. Everything was for sale, and corruption was just rampant. And also it was a time of America undergoing immense change. You know, the Statue of Liberty was being built. You had, you know, again, these incredible corporations that had sprung up overnight. You had this new ruling class of people who actually threw a party in New York where they dressed up like the British, because they saw themselves as royalty and as a royal class of people. And nobody had ever seen this before. You know, nobody had ever become wealthy off people they never saw. Right. And this was the beginning of that, you know. And again, you go back to Carnegie, you know, because you're right, I set it up between the two of them. Carnegie was very interesting because, you know, he became very, very wealthy, but he didn't understand how. Right. He took a year off and wrote a book called Wealth to go, why did I become wealthy when so many others didn't? And his conclusion was sort of stunning. He didn't work hard. In fact, he only worked 4 hours a day. And he really said it was being at the right place at the right time. It was circumstance. He said all these guys who had all this money, they weren't smarter than anybody else. They just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And so that sort of brought him to this, you know, philanthropical bent at the end of his life, or the latter part of his life, of, you know, becoming the literary man, wanting to educate people, push out the library, to make money mean something. And but at the same time, he was ruthless. and you know, he did what he had to do. And
right. Of course, there were some of the information that you have in here has to do with unions and with employees who were discontent and so forth. And
yeah,
you would think with the
Homestead strikes and all that.
And you might think that a guy with a whole boat full of money would think, well, what difference does it make if I pay these guys a nickel more a week or something?
Yeah,
But he was not going to have it, was he?
No, he's very Scottish. I'm half Scottish, so Wilkins inside. And that side is very tight. And that was him. And he basically, he decided arbitrarily he wasn't making enough money from his mills. And so he wanted to cut wages, and he locked everybody out. And that brought about the Homestead strikes with the Pinkertons, all these people getting shot down. Now, as the trial evolved, okay, now this is how far Cassie's come. So they're going to have this trial of the century in Cleveland. And by the way, she was only being charged for the collapse of the Oberlin Bank. And the reason that is because middle-class people got hurt. They lost their money. And so it was a political football. Nobody wanted to be responsible for that. So somebody had to pay, and it was her. And so they had this incredible trial. And as you said, people are like, did he really pay her off? Is she really his daughter? And so newspapers are just covering her, like, unbelievably. And, of course, the big moment is when Carnegie is subpoenaed, and he comes to the trial and faces her in open court. And the reporters are all there, and he walks in. And by the way, Carnegie was only 5 foot tall. In fact, I think he was like 4'11". He had a big white beard. He looked like a miniature Santa Claus. And he comes in, and you know, the courtroom's quiet, and he sits down, and Cassie's sort of looking down, not looking up, looking up, and he's sitting there. And then suddenly they both look up and lock eyes. And the press all covers this. And, you know, Carnegie, who had really been looking for the answer as to why, you know, he had become wealthy when others didn't, saw it in Cassie. He saw that ruthless intent, that the eyes that said she would do anything to get what she wanted. And he realized in this epiphanic moment, that bitch is me. And so, you know, that was the highlight of this trial, which, by the way, was covered more extensively than Teddy Roosevelt's inauguration.
Right.
And, you know, so this was just incredible. And again, what they basically end up convicting Cassie for is passing a bad check. They indict Beckwith and a guy named Spears, who's a teller, who had nothing to do with it. Nothing. But people had to pay.
Yeah.
And they made it like Beckwith was in on it. Beckwith dies. He dies basically from shame.
Right.
And Spears goes to jail for like 3 years, and they let him out later. Cassie is sentenced to 11, and she dies very quickly within 3 years. But she gets the best cell in the entire prison with a view out to the courtyard. So even at the very end, she was still living the life of really the opulent Miss Cassie Chadwick.
Now, and her poor husband ends up declaring bankruptcy with obligations of $500,000 on debts incurred by his wife. It broke his health, and he died a broken man a couple of years later, right?
That's right. I mean, he had no idea what was going on, but they tried to charge him. And then they realized he wasn't in on it, but they took everything he had. Mm. And here's what's interesting. When Beckwith goes, the banker, goes to see Cassie in jail before the trial, he talks to her, and he's got his wife, and he's a broken man. And he says to her, I still believe you are who you say you are, and you will make good on this money. He could not believe that he had been duped. He could not believe that. He could not believe this woman had cleaned out his bank and then cleaned him out personally.
Wow.
And that it ruined his life. And that she was somehow going to pay off all his debts still. And Ira Reynolds, who gave her the $5 million line of credit for the package that had nothing in it, they opened it was worthless. He too said in court that he still believed that she was who she said she was. And people people stared at him like, you know, and they said she had hypnotic eyes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the eye, Newton, Mr. Newton, who really broke the whole thing, went to his death believing that a man was behind all this because a woman could never have understood the complicated financial trust documents, loans, bonds, everything she created, railroad stocks. No woman could have understood all that, and he believed there was a man behind it all.
Good grief. It is an incredible, true story. And once again, you have found a way to give us a glimpse into an era that is very seldom talked about now, but was so critical in the formation of the modern United States, a critical component of what happened to us in the 20th century. And it all began in that post-Civil War era. And I'm with you. I really feel it didn't end until the Titanic went down, because that was the ultimate Gilded Age artifact.
Right.
When it went down, all of a sudden, everybody who'd been naive enough or wishful enough to think, oh, you know, we can just all keep making money and keep spending it and all, that really was kind of the opening act in the what became the Great Depression, was just this little, mm-hmm. here's a little foretaste of a foreshadowing of what's going to happen to the economies of the world. That's what happened to the Titanic.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think the Titanic was a perfect end note, because it really was that gilded class of people going down with that ship. Of course, you know, the third class, of course, went down first. But, you know, they would eventually go down. And then, of course, World War One broke out. So, yeah, I think it's a very interesting, almost 50-year period of American history that transformed the country, no doubt.
A new book that's coming out later, I know we're talking about Greed in the Gilded Age, but I saw it, but The Last Charge of the Rough Rider, Theodore Roosevelt's Final Days. I know how it works when you are talking about a book. You've already got at least one. This is the way you have to do, right? You've got at least one already working on, maybe even two of them. So I look forward to that when you've had some really wonderful books about Theodore Roosevelt, and I'm a huge fan of his. And so
you'll love that one. Also, I have another book coming out in October called Writing Gatsby, the real story behind the writing of the greatest American novel.
Ah, let's see, that's got some South Alabama ties in, too, because Zelda came
Zelda's
from Montgomery,
there.
Which is just an
absolutely.
Hour north of us.
That's right. Yeah, so we'll have to chat about that one.
Absolutely. Well, it is always a great pleasure to get to talk to you. I enjoy your history book so much, and I so appreciate you making time to talk with us when they come out.
Oh, thanks so much, Dave.
Your website?
WilliamHazelgrove.com.
Okay, easy to remember, easy to find. Thanks again, Will.
Yeah.
Great to talk to you, my friend.
Oh, thank you.
Once again, Greed in the Gilded Age, The Brilliant Con of Cassie Chadwick, from William Elliott Hazelgrove, Rowland and Littlefield. You can find it at bookstores and online, and you can also check out his website, WilliamHazelgrove.com. So we'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.